Today is May 26th in the year 2000. This is Raymond Gerler, and I am interviewing Robert Manck for the oral history program of the Byrd Polar Research Center archival program, a program that is funded by the National Science Foundation. Mr. Manck, I appreciate your willingness to cooperate in this program. Can you begin by discussing what motivated you to join the Navy? What aspirations did you have?
Well, at the time of my life, I was 17 years old. Joining the Navy or staying in high school were my options at the time. I was a good student in industrial arts and history, but not in English and the sciences. And I also was in a school system that was basically college prep and didn't offer very much in my line of, you know, industrial arts or trades. I always had the urge to travel, but never had the opportunity. So I had left school with 1 year to go and joined the Navy in 1957, September. At the time, I thought it was the best thing for me, and that's what I did. I had heard of the Seabees as a young boy growing up from an uncle who was a Seabee during World War II, and listened to his tales and everything. It sounded good. Plus, he was also in the same line of work that I am in now. When I joined the Navy, I requested training as a Seabee, but because I wasn't a high school graduate, they couldn't guarantee it. Mm-hmm. So I just, you know, took my chances and enlisted anyway. And as it turned out, with the tests they give you after you're in boot camp, I guess I scored all right on that part of it, and they did put me in to the Seabees. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Because right after boot camp, I was sent to Utilities Men's School in California to learn air conditioning, refrigeration, boilers, pumps, and compressors. And then upon completion of 16 weeks of school, I was assigned to Midway Island, which, well, here's my traveling was starting. They put me in the Public Works Department out there, which is mostly all Seabees doing base maintenance. At first, Midway was a beautiful island, not quite the South Pacific though, but it was an interesting place to be with the Goonie Birds and what have you. But as a single 18-year-old, there wasn't any liberty, dates, etc. So it became a little on the boring side after a while. You probably couldn't wait to get out of there. But after being there for 8 months, the Navy asked for volunteers for the Antarctic program. Naturally, I thought, well, this is a lot different. So I volunteered, raised my hand. And 3 weeks later, I was on my way to Davisville, Rhode Island for training for the Antarctic.
Yeah. Can you discuss that special training that you received in Rhode Island for your service in Antarctica?
Yes. The trainings basically started with physicals, which both body and mental, which was probably the most important thing. They weren't going to go any farther if you couldn't get through that.
By mental, you mean psychological?
Yes.
Okay.
Part of the mental was we had gone to three different psychiatrists, and two of them had to pass you in mm-hmm. order to go. The physical part wasn't any problem. We went to lectures on what to expect in Antarctica. as far as living conditions, working conditions, the cold. We went to schools and worked with heavy gloves on to simulate the conditions down there, which Rhode Island in the summer was nothing like Antarctica in the winter. But anyway, we erected buildings, handling nuts and bolts with these heavy gloves on. We were taught to drive heavy equipment, Caterpillar tractors, snowcats, weasels, etc. Vehicles that we would be familiar with down there. And we had movies on the Antarctic from previous expeditions. And that basically was it, other than we were prepared, all our clothes were, we were fitted for our winter clothes and things of that nature. That was basically the training that I can recall at this time. There may have been.
Yeah. How, do you recall roughly how long the training was?
Approximately 6 months. Mm-hmm. We were in Davisville.
Okay.
And I also had earned my GED diploma while I was in Davisville, so that, I guess, made up for the part that not finishing high school. As I was slated to winter over at McMurdo Sound, I didn't give any thought as to what lay ahead as to my job and duties there. I had a general idea what I'd be doing, but until you get to a place, you never know. I think the biggest thing on my mind at the time was the flight from Christchurch to McMurdo Sound. I found out I wasn't the most calmest flying over all that cold water, the 13 hours in the air on a 124 Globemaster, but we all survived that flight. I think that was, at the time, that was my biggest concern. Being down there wasn't a problem. It was just getting there to the, it's a lot different today. After about a week at McMurdo, getting settled in, etc., I was told to pack all my gear, and I was being sent to Little America 5, and the reason being they were closing that base and taking all the equipment out that they could. There were quite a few tractors there, traverse, sleds, and what have you, that they wanted to get to Bird Station. I was also told that I was going to go on the overland traverse to Bird. And that would be my final duty station. They were changing my duty is what they were doing. And I did not know the reason at the time, but it worked out real well. I was at Little America 5, I was working for an Army Colonel, Merrill Dawson, who was, I guess, an expert at the time on transantarctic travel over snow and ice. I was very happy to get a chance at this. This was quite an adventure I had not expected. At Little America 5, I was keeping the base heated, snow melters working, getting the sleds, overland sleds, which they called Wanigans, one for sleeping, one for eating. We were getting those ready, checking over all the plumbing for the snow melters on those, all that. About a week before we were to leave on the tractor train, Colonel Dawson told me that space was tight and that I wouldn't be going on there, but they needed me at Bird anyway for a replacement. And I guess that evening I was put on the USS Glacier, which was parked at the Ross Ice Shelf. And to go back McMurdo to catch a flight to go into Bird Station. Boarding the glacier off the ice shelf was quite an adventure in itself, climbing up a ladder and all that, which I remember vividly. I spent 3 days on an icebreaker. It was my first time on a Navy ship, and only time that my time in the Navy was 3 days I was put on the glacier as a passenger to go back McMurdo. one day out, we got into real heavy ice. Breaking the ice was slow going, so after 3 days, they flew me off in a helicopter to McMurdo, where at the time I was supposed to go right on the bird, but the bird station was weathered in. They were having a bad storm there. So while waiting for the weather to clear,
So you took the helicopter from the glacier to McMurdo.
Yes. Due to bad weather at Bird Station, I was sitting at McMurdo for 3 days, and on Thanksgiving Day in McMurdo, they said I was to fly out that night to Bird Station, which I had my Thanksgiving at McMurdo. The next day I flew back across the International Dateline and landed at Bird Station on Thanksgiving, so that year I enjoyed two Thanksgivings, I guess. Just thought I'd throw that in. But I had never given any thought, once I got to Bird, I had never given any thought for volunteering for an outlying station, not knowing that much about what went on down at the Antarctic, but I'm glad I had the opportunity to winter over at Bird. The many people I knew from Davisville were stationed there, a total of 10 Navy altogether and 11 civilian scientists. The adjustment was very easy for me. As for the scientists who I all met for the first time, I got to know each and every one of them as time progressed. My main duties at Bird was keeping the base heated, heaters refueled, snow melters working, pumps working on the snow melter system. That summer, after I got there, we erected two new barracks buildings and a new truck garage and also a generator house. These had to be put down on the same level as the base, which was approximately 10 feet under the ice and snow at that time. We had to help out with snow removal after storms, etc. Basically, what a pipe fitter would do here in the winter in the States, I was also doing the work down there. Just general maintenance on my part. I was also the wash machine repairman, dryer repairman. Our only refrigeration unit was in the sick bay area, which halfway through our tour there, the refrigerator went. I had to repair that, which was quite interesting as we did not have a lot of parts, but we did get it working. It was vital as to the drugs and medication that were kept there in case of emergencies. Once a month, approximately, Chief Davis and I would have to refuel our fuel storage tanks down below. This meant going outside in any kind of weather, digging the bare drums of diesel fuel out of the snow from our supply area, which was airdropped earlier in the summer. We had approximately 2,000 gallons each month to pump in down into the base, but after it was quite an operation digging out the barrels, we had to load them on 20-ton sleds, bring them back to the base, and then start the pumping operation down underneath the ice. This was an operation that had to be done every month, summer and winter. I had to go out every day and refuel the only building that was on top of the snow, where they released the weather balloons twice a day. It seemed each day at Bird was a challenge due to the cold weather and the constant wind blowing.
Mr. Mank, airlifting and retrieval of supplies was vital to the operation of the base. Can you give a little more detail about how things were airlifted, stored, and then recovered?
Yes. Everything was airdropped to us by C-124 Globemasters at that time. They would call ahead, let us know when they were coming, and we would be out on a drop zone, which was marked off. There was an area marked off where we wanted all our supplies dropped. They would come in, drop the parachutes. We never knew what we were getting until it landed on the ground, whether it was diesel fuel, parts to run the base, machine parts, etc. After the parachutes were dropped and they flew off, we would retrieve all the supplies, check off what we had, and they would be stored on top of the ice in different areas. All these areas were marked with long bamboo poles with red flags on the top. A sketch was drawn as to where each different supplies were marked, because in time, with the blowing and drifting snow, everything would be covered. So we drew a sketch. We knew where everything was if and when we had to get it. As for the fuel, which was the biggest area, it was all set on top of the snow and ice, but we had to dig it out when we went out for this refueling operation. And it seemed the colder it got, and it was completely dark during the winter, it was tougher and tougher as the fuel was getting low, you know, lower and lower. We had to do more digging.
Okay. Good.
In the summer, we worked 7 days a week, 12-hour shifts, with Sunday evening off for a movie and popcorn. We had 2 days off that summer, Christmas and New Year's, and then worked every day till winter set in at the end of February. There were not too many problems that I was aware of that came up. Of course, I wasn't running the base. I was just one of the people to help keep it going. Day-to-day little problems would come up, and we'd work together and solve whatever it was, whether a building was starting to creak or something was caving in. We had to do a lot of shoring up as the buildup of snow and ice on top of us was getting heavier and heavier as the winter progressed. Those I can remember being the biggest problems. The last plane left us in late February of 1960. And I think at that time, it hit me that we were truly alone. And I got to thinking of a lot of what ifs. What if war broke out in the States or someplace else and everybody went there and we were stuck down here? We knew we had 2 years' supply of food and fuel, but you know, all these thoughts go through your head as the last plane leaves, and you know, we were isolated there until the following October. Also, what if one of us got seriously ill? Could we trust the doctor, who was also the base commander? And we didn't know that much about him, but myself being only 19, I was the youngest one there. At first, I did not have too much in common with the other 9 Navy personnel. I was single. The rest were married, some with children. They were in their mid to late 20s. The civilian scientists were older, late 20s to late 30s. In time, I seemed to mesh with everyone. And although I didn't have all the sea stories and experiences of others, I enjoyed the time shared with everyone. To this day, I still remember mostly everyone, both Navy and civilian scientists. and can remember stories told by each. Some of the Navy people, four of us to be exact, have kept in touch over the years, Christmas cards and what have you. And after about 30 years of sending Christmas cards back and forth, sometimes notes, letters, we thought it would be a good idea to maybe have a reunion with the people we could find, and we tried to find others. This was 1991. Well, we did locate five Navy people total to have a reunion. As we did not have any luck in finding the rest of them, the reunion never came about. But we all agreed that we would try and visit one another. And it was quite amazing to me when I had met these people at their homes. A couple of them have been to mine. We would sit down and talk, and it was like we had never been apart after 31 years. We just seemed to pick up, the conversation just seemed to pick up and go from that time or the time we were there. And that was struck me as remarkable. I guess living in such tight conditions, you learn a lot about everyone, you know, their whole histories, as we had no one else to talk to in all that time.
Let's stop. Mr. Mank, would you comment on the command of the base at Bird Station?
Well, we had one officer who was a doctor, and he was also in charge of the base. Normally a doctor doesn't hold command in the Navy of any base, but in this case they made an exception. And on the civilian side they had one scientist that was in charge. The doctor, who was a very nice person, got along well with everybody. He was just out of medical school, and I didn't think, my own observation, I didn't think that he wanted to be there. He had told us that. He was forced to take the assignment. He had no choice, as we were all volunteers. He had to come here and spend a year, 14 months. He would go off on by himself sometimes. We wouldn't see him for a week or two. He'd be working or being up at night, and we worked days and slept nights during the winter. There was not too much interaction with him military-wise. We had a chief petty officer, Chief Davis, who basically ran the base for the whole year on the military side, handing out job assignments, what had to be done, things of that nature. The civilian scientist, we did have a lot of interaction with the scientist, as they were a part of us. We had our meals together. The only difference, we didn't work together. They had their jobs, we had ours. For the most part, it was very cordial working with the scientist. We had learned, I had learned about the different jobs they do, jobs I never realized existed. Some of the scientific, such as the scientists, such as studying the ionosphere gases at the time, I remember, the releasing of the weather balloons twice a day. But everyone seemed to get along real well. The only time we wouldn't see the scientists around was after a storm, when we had to do a lot of manual snow removal to get in and out. They seemed to disappear, which was okay, I guess. But we thought, well, maybe they should be doing their part too, because, you know, it was their livelihood that we were protecting also. But they did help out on mess duties. They everyone had took their turn. Once a week you had to do the dishes for the cook and clean up after meals, etc., fill the snow melter for the cook, and they did help out on that. They That's about all I can say on that, I think.
Okay.
From what I can remember, as far as any conflicts between the Navy and the civilian scientists, the only part that they wouldn't help out in is when, after bad storms, we were left with a lot of snow blown on top of some of the buildings that were questionable as to whether they would cave in or not. As we couldn't get heavy equipment on top of these buildings, everything had to be shoveled, hand shoveled away, and we just thought the more hands that were available, the easier it would be for everybody. A few of the scientists, two in particular I can remember helping out, the rest definitely would not do the manual labor. I guess they figured that wasn't part of their duty.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I remember just about everyone that I wintered over with. When I look back at the pictures, I remember pleasant times spent together under the most adverse conditions. I think the things that got to me the most were the constant wind blowing. After a while, it's just that was the only noise we heard, especially in the winter, because everything being so quiet, there was no outward noises outside. It was just that constant whistling of the wind. Also, at night, when you were in your bunk, the buildings would be creaking under the weight of all that snow. I think at the beginning of the winter, we had about 10 feet on top of us, and at the end, when we left, there was close to 20 feet of snow that had accumulated on top of the buildings. So you would lay in your bed and you would hear this constant shifting, or whatever it was, of the weight of the snow. That was, I think, our biggest concern. One storm I'll never forget, we had winds over 100 miles an hour, temperatures at 50 below zero, and it lasted for 8 days. It bent our radio antennas, the constant wind blowing, it just bent them right in half. Didn't break them, just bent them, but we lost most of the communication. We could not go outside and fix them because of the strong winds and the cold. It also blew off any of the smokestacks that came up through the ice from the buildings. And after the storm, it took me over a week to go and replace all the smokestacks, sometimes having to climb down on top of the buildings and replacing the whole stack, which was a concern to me. Climbing down into the ice, it was climbing down like into a crevasse, mm-hmm. while the heat opened up. But we did get the job done, I got my part, and I was glad of that.
Mr. Bank, would you comment on the group as a whole during the wintering over experience?
Well, as the winter progressed and we were all huddled down inside, there were not too many tensions that I can recall between the civilians and the Navy. We all seemed to get along fairly well. We had a lot of good times together, talks and what have you. There were a couple of the civilians that seemed to be loners. They went off by themselves. They did their job and didn't seem to socialize or interact too much with the Navy, but that was okay. They didn't, there was no hostilities or anything like that. They did their thing and we did ours. But basically everyone seemed to get along. I was not aware of any problems. I think as the winter progressed, we were all just looking for the summer to come again and the chance to get out of there, or our chance to get out of there.
So there wasn't, that you noticed anyway, any depression during this very dark period?
None that I can recall. One of the weathermen there, his wife's had a baby while we were down there, and I know he was probably the most that I noticed that couldn't wait to get out of there. I can understand that now. I couldn't then, but you know, having your first child and you're down in the South Pole and your wife's back in New York, and it was tough on him, and I know that bothered him, and he was one of the first ones out, I think, on the first plane. They took him out so he could get back.
Yeah. Some of the previous people that I've interviewed commented on the importance of ham radio as a connecting to the outside world. Did you have that experience at Bird Station?
Oh, yes. I felt quite fortunate. One of the nice things of being at Bird in a small base like that, we had the chance to use the ham radio as our communication to the outside world. In fact, I got good at operating the radio, and some of my leisure hours was spent talking to people all over the world. I had I think they call it a radio patch, I've forgotten now, set up with a gentleman in my area of New York, and every Tuesday night at 8 o'clock, we would meet on the radio, and I would get the chance to talk to my parents, my girlfriend, who's now my wife. We had a chance to chat for a little while, and it was very nice. I think being at McMurdo, the people didn't have the opportunity to use the radio that often, but so I felt fortunate that way, that I did have some outside communication on a regular basis with the outside world.
Mr. Mank, you were at Bird Station, and you almost made it to the South Pole. Would you care to comment, please?
Well, all the equipment that was bought from Little America 5 the previous summer was bought into Bird Station with the idea of it going on to the South Pole base, as at that time they did not have the heavy equipment at the pole base due to the logistics of, they had no way of getting it there other than over on land or on ice. I had the chance to go on the Traverse from Bird Station to the South Pole base, a distance of about 900 miles, and it was the first time this was ever tried through a lot of uncharted territory, especially crevasses crossing the mountains. It would have been a very interesting trip, as they were taking D8 Caterpillar tractors and other heavy equipment into the pole, South Pole base. But as my time approached to leave, I decided to go stateside and get on with my life, so I turned it down. And I had previously talked to people that went on it, and I probably should have gone on it for the experience, but that's something that can't be, you know, you can't go back to. But they all told me it was quite an adventure, being the first time. Mm-hmm. I was discharged March of 61. Not knowing at the time, fortunately I didn't re-enlist, I can remember other people getting orders to Indochina, not knowing what they were getting into. At that time, the Vietnam War was starting up before people even heard of Vietnam, and the Seabees were over there building airstrips, bases, and I guess getting ready for the war. So I'm glad I did take my discharge and depart from the Navy. I've been a member of the Polar Society for about the past 10 years due to Tom Oswald, who had told me about this. And I enjoy reading about the events that are still going on, all the new discoveries, both on land and underwater. I was saddened to hear that the Navy is no longer used there after so many years. I would very much like to return and see all the changes. I follow the National Geographic specials on Antarctica and read any news items that come my way. I read of the last large iceberg that broke off from the Ross Ice Shelf, about the size of Rhode Island. They're tracking that. Any events that I do read about the Antarctic are all interesting. There's been an awful lot of changes since I've been there. When we went down in 1959, we were basically camping out as compared to the way, from what I understand, the bases are now, especially having women there, which was unheard of back when I wintered over. Upon coming back to this area, I married my girlfriend, Barbara, in 1962. She wrote and we talked on amateur radio while I was on the ice. We have three children, boy being the oldest, and two girls. Being married for about almost 37 years, and we now have seven grandchildren. I started a job in February of 62 at Western Electric in Buffalo, New York, which is now Lucent Technologies, and was accepted into the maintenance department as a pipe fitter due to my Navy experience. I worked for them for 15 years, and they moved out of town, closed up the place. I went across the street to a General Motors Chevrolet Forge, also as a pipe fitter. Worked there for 21 years until 1997, when it was sold to an outside concern. To stay with General Motors, I transferred here to Lockport, New York, GM Harrison Radiator. I hope to work six more years and then retire after 30 years at GM. Sure, I have the Navy to thank for starting me in the right direction and giving me a chance, and giving me a career. All the train that had started with the Navy stayed with me through my whole working life. Although I regret dropping out of high school, I still think I did the right thing by joining the Navy. I have never lost a day of work due to job changes. I left one place on a Friday, started the next on a Monday. This I attribute to the Navy training and teaching me a trade. I make good money at what I do, and they've given me a comfortable lifestyle. I think my experience in the Antarctic taught me that I can survive the harshest environments, the isolation. I learned how to get along well with people, work well with people. If anyone can winter over in the South Pole, I think, if anyone can winter over in the South Pole, I think it'd teach them to survive just about anything that comes up their way in life. I'm told when we went to the South Pole in 1959 that at the time there were less than 1,500 people who had wintered over there. That was known. I am proud to have had the opportunity. I know it made me a better person.
Yeah. Mr. Mank, it's clear from your previous discussion that you have very fond memories of your experience in Antarctica, especially at Bird Station. And I suspect that part of the reason you have such good memories is because of the social aspects of living in Bird Station. Can you comment on that part of life?
Oh, sure. Everyone seemed to get along, like I said before, fairly well. Our cook there, who was the only cook we had, on everyone's birthday, he always made a cake for them. I think he worked the hardest of anybody at the base because he had to be there three meals a day, every day, and being the only cook, he had to do all the preparation, all of that. On Sunday nights in the summer, we had our movie, which was our only entertainment for the week. And he always made sure we had enough hot buttered popcorn, things of that nature, which made it all that important. As the time went on and we wintered in, we were down inside most of the time. We would have occasional parties, whether for holidays, Memorial Day, 4th of July, would be our big parties, and we would really get into socializing. One point, take for granted back here, all your drinks have to be refrigerated in the States, beer, soft drinks, etc. Down there, everything was frozen, being stored outside. So when it was bought inside, all our beer had to be warmed up, our soft drinks had to be warmed up, so we could consume them. As everything that we had down there was frozen at one time or another. We got into some good parties. Everybody enjoyed themselves. And I think this all helped to make us more close to one another as far as getting along, things of that nature. We had a mid-winter O-ring party sometime in July of that winter. It was like our halfway point there, or the halfway through the winter anyways. And I can remember the doctor, the one officer, and our chief petty officer dressed up in white shirts, ties, and all that, and they served us a sit-down dinner, took our orders, made it a restaurant setting, which was very nice. This was something they didn't have to do, and probably in their whole Navy career never expected to do anything like this, serving enlisted men, plus the civilian scientists. They came and took our orders. They had our plates made up and bought it back. One of the highlights, I guess, of the year was having the officer and the chief petty officer serving the enlisted men.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mr. Mank, Bird Station had some physical details or aspects of physical existence at Bird Station that were different from McMurdo. Would you comment, please?
Well, at the time I didn't know it. I was glad that I got the chance to winter over at Bird. I think being with a smaller group of people was a lot more enjoyable on the whole base. Or, of course, that was my own observation at the time. Our living conditions at Bird, we were all in separate rooms, basically. The ceiling was open, but we all had our own separate rooms. So we did have that little bit of privacy that you wouldn't have at the main station like McMurdo, where everybody was in a barracks type affair. Our heating system was kept at about 65 degrees inside the barracks, and it was a forced air system that we had, where at McMurdo they had basically space heaters in each building, so the people on the top bunks would be very uncomfortable with the heat, or that would be the preferred place to be for the warmth, and the people on the bottom bunks were a lot colder and had to use a lot, whether sleeping bag or more blankets or whatever they used. That was an advantage. I think just being with a smaller group of people, to me, was a better advantage than being in a whole community. That was my perspective of it.
Okay. Mr. Mank, the social aspect was, of course, a significant for group cohesion. Can you talk a little bit more about the parties and the honor system in place at Bird Station?
Well, being that we were at an isolated station, we didn't have a club to go to for socializing. We didn't have what would normally be a bar or an enlisted men's club. So we had to make our own. The builder there in his spare time put together a beautiful bar, and it was written up in papers down there at the time. He built a back bar, and mostly just out of scrap lumber and what have you. As we weren't paid down there the whole time we were there, any purchases we had to make, such as beer, soft drinks, film for the cameras, toothpaste, stuff of a personal nature, was about all we had to buy, and cigarettes, was all put on an honor system. If we went and purchased something or took something, we wrote down on the paper what it was, And when we got back to McMurdo after our tour, everything was going to be cashed out at that time, and that's when we pay our bill and take any money that was due us. But this worked out very well. When we went, for the people who were drinking, as I remember now, we had two kinds of beer down there, Budweiser and Miller. And when at that time, when you froze beer, at least Budweiser beer, in order to drink it, you had to thaw it out. But the yeast used to separate from the beer, I guess. So in the process of drinking it, you would have all these clammy-like soft goobers, which was the yeast separated from the beer. So all the beer drinkers had their little piece of cheesecloth that they would put over their glass and strain the beer so they could drink it like a normal beer would taste, I guess. Myself not being a beer drinker, I didn't have that problem. I was more into Cokes, what have you, soft drinks. We did have what they called a whiteout punch that was used for different holidays and celebrations, Christmas and New Year's, what have you.
Let me interrupt a moment. I'm getting the tape warning light, so let's continue on the other side. First interview with Robert Mank on Friday, May 26th in the year 2000. You were talking about the difficulties that the beer drinkers experienced in dealing with thawed beer, especially Budweiser.
Yes, that was the straining of Budweiser. Miller didn't seem to affect, but the Miller we ran out of probably about 4 months into our tour, just after the planes left, only because that was the favorite beer that people didn't have to strain. And then the beer drinkers were left with Budweiser for the rest of the year. We also made a concoction on holidays or special days, what they called whiteout punch. And the ingredients in that was 190 proof medicinal alcohol, along with different kinds of fruit punches that were added, and it was made into a punch. Two glasses of this was very potent, and you were usually on your way to a very melancholy evening, so to speak. But I can remember our cook, who was from the mountains of Tennessee and was into distilling, I guess, various liquids in his youth. He could drink this stuff straight, this 190 proof alcohol, and we had made bets on it that he couldn't. Well, he didn't show us. Well, after that, because of the seriousness of the way that leaves you, the doctor, also the base commander, poured the rest of it down the drain. That was the end of that, because he didn't want anybody getting into any serious difficulties. And that was the end of any kind of drinks other than the beer. But halfway through at the midwinter party, the doctor, unbeknownst to us, bought down a bottle of I.W. Harper. I guess it's bourbon, I'm not sure, I don't remember now. And each one of us was given a bottle at the midwinter party when they were serving us. I think when I left there, I may have taken two or three sips out of mine, and I left it with the person that replaced me. That tells you what kind of a drinker I was.
Mr. Mank, I appreciate your willingness to participate in this program. This brings us to the end of the interview, and I think we've captured some very useful details and insight. I appreciate your cooperation. Thank you.
Thank you.